Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Happy Friday morning.
Well, noon, but close enough.
Oh.
Happy Friday morning to you.
Yes. Thank you. I'll take it. I get 3 more hours of it. So take that, Dan. Take that, calendar.
Stupid calendar and your time zones.
Yeah. People who, if are there new listeners to the Six Colors, there may be some new listeners to the Six Colors podcast. Calendar is sort of the patron saint of the Six Colors podcast, a cruel mythological figure that makes us record a podcast at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern on Fridays. And then occasionally a different time. But he or it or they or she, who knows? It's a being of indescribable power, so probably she, but you know, you don't know.
Infinite in time and space.
Exactly right.
A vengeful god, as I like to think of
it. I didn't know
them.
We were going down the route of calendar mythology, but here we are. Anyway, thank calendar, because that's the reason that this is a weekly podcast and not a totally random occasional podcast.
And that's what I say every time something amazing happens in life. Thank calendar!
Yes, indeed.
Praise be unto them.
Yes, praise be to calendar that we are here, except for those moments then when we can't, because one of us is not around on Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific, at which point.
Sure.
It's a different noon Eastern, 5 UK time.
Mountain time.
It's...
I always remember being a kid and listening to...
10 mountain time. It's confusing knowing people who live in mountain time. Yeah, I know.
Sorry. I just remember being when I was a kid and like they would do, you know, promos for shows. And you're like, yes, tune in at 9 p.m. or...
8 Central.
8 Central, right? Like, because it's the same, the show aired at the same time.
It's just one
in
feed.
Eastern and Central, because they're like, why bother? But then in Pacific, it would be on a different time. Cause,
Yeah.
They still do that? Does stuff still air both in Eastern and Central, and then it's a different time in Pacific presumably Mountain?
I think Eastern and Central both get it at the actual time, the simultaneous time. And then I believe Mountain gets it delayed. They delay it 2 hours, and the West Coast gets it delayed 3 hours. I think that's how for those who are still watching broadcast television, I think that's
right.
Still
well, yeah, watch. Sure. That's the other question, is like how many people.
I had this is a tangent I also didn't expect. This is an unexpected episode here, but that happens when it's you and me, and we can talk about whatever we want. I am frustrated by the fact that cable and satellite providers still offer, like, if you've got a linear channel, they offer an East Coast and a West Coast feed.
Right.
And the I think it's silly. I understand why they do it, because they want to have, like, their best stuff in primetime. But
sure,
most cable channels already adapted to this by showing their primetime lineup twice, right? They show it at 8 o'clock Eastern, and then they show it again at 11 o'clock Eastern, which is 8 o'clock Pacific, and everybody is happy. And my frustration here is that I often am watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on Sunday night. It's sort of like I can time it where I can just watch that live, which I enjoy greatly. Except if I want to watch it live and not wait 45 minutes to an hour for it to be on HBO Max now, not now Max now. I have to watch it on the East Coast feed on my cable system, which is standard def.
Oh,
and I don't. It's stupid. Fortunately, I think we've reached the point now where instead of looking for reform from linear television, we can just look for linear television to vanish. That would be better.
Yeah, I mean, I hear from lots of friends who, you know, whose kids grew up without commercials, for example, and are just totally either bemused or weirdly fixated when the commercials do come on and stuff they watch. And I think that probably it'd be a similar thing with, like, this thing only comes on at a certain time. And they're like, what? A certain time?
No,
that's
weird. My kids are definitely like that. They think commercials are really annoying pre-rolls in YouTube that you have to tap next on or skip on. That's what they think commercials are now. But watching Sports Coming Back has exposed me to all sorts of commercials that I have not seen or not seen in years. And it's terrifying, because it's like, oh, no. Like, I'm not going to say its name, because it's the archenemy of calendar, I've decided. Mm-hmm. But there is a phone number that will procure vehicles for children in a sort of a charity sense, and they have a charming song that they sing about,
a jingle, if you will.
About it's call this phone number for vehicles for children. That's how it's.
I think it's that catchy. I don't know.
And that's playing during the baseball games, Dan. And I have to now ride. I have to keep my finger on the mute button the entire time.
Well, our friend Lex Friedman was telling us the other day on the latest episode of The Rebound, I think, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, but his kids had started memorizing jingles because they had been watching something on a service with commercials.
Oh, yeah.
And he was like, why do you know that? Like, and they're like enjoying it. They're like, ooh, this it's that commercial. And he's like, why? Why? I just want to skip through this. That's how they get you.
Yeah. My wife's superpower is remembering all the jingles from her childhood.
She knows all.
So our cat, one of our two cats, is named Cheddar, and mm-hmm. I have started to refer to her with every product that has Cheddar in the name. Cheddar biscuits, Cheddar bunnies, and the one that I do a lot is Better Cheddars, which people may not remember, but I remember not only the product, it was a cracker, but I remember the entire jingle from the commercial from the 80s. Which I will not sing, but it's available on YouTube if you want to find it.
Nothing is ever lost anymore.
Well, that's one of my favorite things about old stuff on YouTube. And this is like, we experienced this with the Star Wars Holiday Special, but it's true with a lot of old stuff on YouTube is it's pulled off of somebody's VHS tape and it has the commercials. And I have that for some shows that I was going through my Max Headroom tapes. Before, because I taped those and I saved them because it was never available again, that show. And then they put it out on DVD finally, so I was able to do that. And it was like, okay, yeah, Max Headroom, great. I love that show. But then it was like, ooh, this episode I didn't cut the commercials out of. And the commercials are amazing.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Vintage commercials are the best.
Oh, I get even better than that are in the 90s when my friends, including our friend Tony Sindelar, and I used to go to MIT to go watch anime late night on Fridays because that was like the only place you could find it at that point. There were occasionally like stuff that was brought over from Japan and it was taped off Japanese TV. And sometimes you get the Japanese commercials
and they were
just bananas. So like there's the Japanese Ronald McDonald and just like every once in a while, like someone had tried to edit them out, but it was all VHS. So they wouldn't do a very precise job. It's not like today with like digital stuff where it's like, yeah, cut it here, you're done. You would get like a split second glimpse. And I just always remember this one of the Ronald McDonald standing next to a film projector and like gesturing at the screen, but like that was the only frame we got, and then flip back to the show, like, and everyone was like, "What was that?"
Flipbird of Japanese Ronald McDonald, saying back to the show. Yes, and I feel like we've had this conversation, but maybe not on a podcast before, because my experience with that was I watched Iron Chef before it hit it big in America because it was aired weekly on the Japanese TV channel in San Francisco. The word got around that it had a cult following, and it was in Japanese with English subtitles. The version that they ended up running on the Food Network was dubbed, except for the chairman, who was not dubbed because he's too special and powerful for that. But our version was not dubbed, just English subtitles, because they knew too that it was a cult hit. And all the commercials were Japanese commercials. Not all; they were mostly for things in San Francisco, so they're local, but they're in Japanese.
Okay. Gotcha.
And some of them were for Japanese products and stuff. And again, and some of this is just being on the other side of a cultural divide, because I think, as we previously just stated, our own English language commercials for our audience are bananas. To take out the cultural context, whether it's by going back in time or going to a different language or a different culture, it's like, what am I? Because it strips off the assumptions you make, and all you're left with is just the naked insanity of this. So, and I'm going to share this is my favorite podcast ever. I'm going to show you another tip for all the listeners out there if you want to do something similar, which is, have you ever really looked at the writing on the packaging of the products you buy, especially food products? Because I'm interested in design stuff. You know, the whole Mac world is sort of intertwined with the design world. And I was commenting yesterday about the new logo and name for the Seattle Kraken, the new NHL team, because I'm fascinated by like sports design and logos on TV show, on like sports TV and stuff like that. But packaging design is another area that's that fascinates me. And Cable Sasser's Twitter feed often has new products in it, and I'm always fascinated by new consumer products that they have a little big new starburst and they try to explain what it is.
Right.
But if you can disconnect yourself, because most of the stuff is never going to be read by anybody, but like get out a box of crackers or something. Not Better Cheddars, they're no longer made. and just look at some of the things they put on them, because basically the job of the package designer is to fill the space.
Right.
And they probably got a brief from somebody in marketing about how they should use this phrase or that phrase. But I find that when you really critically look at why things have been placed on a box, you very quickly, the scales drop from your eyes and you realize, oh, this is bananas. This should not. Why is this? Why did they put this here? Because, yeah. And again, it's that thing where you let it wash over you and you're like, yeah, whatever. And then you apply critical eye and you're like, what are they? Why is this? What is this ad copy on this box? And what does it mean? Yeah, that's all.
As a kid, though, I remember I used to avidly read the cereal boxes, and they would actually, I mean, sometimes they would put games and stuff on them, but sometimes it was just marketing copy. But like, you know, you're a kid, you're sitting there in the morning, you're bleary eyed, you had to get up
for school.
You're eating your cereal. And the only thing that's there usually, like, you know, before I started reading like the newspaper or turning on, I think we had a television in the kitchen eventually.
How decadent.
The cereal box. Yeah, I know. You just read the cereal box. You feel like, what's up?
Yeah.
What's new in the land of cereal boxes?
Yeah. What news from Captain Crunch? The cereal boxes, I would argue, are probably were designed for people to read them.
Probably the best out of any packaging, I would have
but
to say.
I'm just saying, if you're like got your toast in the toaster and you're just sitting there waiting and you're by your pantry or whatever, just pick up a random product and observe some of the copy that's on it, because beyond the nutrition facts and the ingredients list and all the things that they're mandated, and probably a picture of the product and a big logo, it's the details. Actually, I was reminded of this week because Cable Sasser from Panic posted a tweet that was about how Beaver's Sweet Hot Mustard, which is my favorite condiment and has gluten in it, which is I couldn't eat it for a year and I was very sad, but I'm back on the gluten and I'm back on the sweet hot mustard. Beaver did a redesign of all their labels, and it's fascinating because there's the I hate change part, which is like, no, old label is what I buy. New label is weird. I don't like new label.
Right, right.
And then there's then you sort of get a little perspective and you're like, oh, the current label has like a weird marker felt kind of font with a stroke applied to it for the name of the it's like, why? And the new one is much simpler and cleaner and it's all. But the thing that really fascinated me is they added the text like Larry, Hall of Famer Larry's, above Sweet Hot Mustard, and then below it, it says like gold medalist or something. It's this, and it's like, who is Hall of Famer Larry? Who is Larry? What is in the Hall of Fame? What does it mean? And I think that's what they want you to think is like, oh, that seems impressive and yet mysterious in some way. But again, somebody sat there and said, you know, knowing that Larry is the founder of the company and he's in the Hall of Fame of the condiment board or something. I don't know what, but he is. I looked it up. But I find it fascinating that that's the decision they made to put that completely meaningless information on the label, hoping that it sparks something in somebody in an aisle somewhere where they're looking for hot mustard.
Oh,
and they're like, oh,
Hall of Famer
Larry or whatever his name is. I don't even know what his name is. I made up Larry, but yeah, I'm fascinated by that kind of stuff. So
it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think what fascinates me about it is that like fundamentally at the end of the day, that's somebody's job. Right? Like somebody worked. Oh, I'm not going to say they didn't work hard or they did work hard. I don't know. It probably depends on the person and the company they work for. But somebody had to write that, right? You know, it's not just a one of those bots online that comes up with ideas for the next season of Star Trek. It's, you know, actually somebody sitting down and thinking like, I have to fill space. But I also must say something that will arguably make some sort of additional attraction to this.
A lot of it is like, enjoy it with your friends or have, you know, Lay's potato chips, have fun, where it's like, what? Why? By the way, it's Gene. It's Gene. He's the chairman of Beaverton Foods and was inducted in 2016 into the Specialty Food Hall of Fame. So it says Hall of Famer Gene's Sweet Hot Mustard.
Okay. Well, there's an explanation. There you go.
Yeah. Anyway, good Sudoku came out this week from Zach Gage. And I was kicking myself because Gruber wrote a thing that was exactly what I was going to write, which is Zach Gage is one of the few people who like is like a musician or an artist or something where like, oh, Zach Gage has a new game because his games are so good that when he is... collaborating with somebody in this case, but on a new game, it's like you got to sit up and pay attention. I don't care about Sudoku at all.
Same.
Although I played Sudoku for the first time yesterday because of this game, and I kind of get it now. I get why it appeals to people.
I get it. I have no interest in it. I just zero. Even though I agree, his app is great. I was on the beta test for it, slight pre-release, whatever. And I tried it out, and I was like, if I liked Sudoku, this would be the app that I used. But I don't like Sudoku. It's just a miss for me.
Words. Hey, crossword puzzle fans. Words getting you down.
Try numbers.
How about numbers?
You know all the numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not what I'm here for.
Exactly. But anyway, it was fun that came out, and Gruber had the same observation I had, which is just like, I like Zach Gage. Flip-flop Solitaire is a classic. Really Bad Chess is great.
Pocket Run Pool
is great. The Cards of Darkness is a really good game that was too hard, and I had to give it up, but it was fun while it lasted in Apple Arcade. Lots of good stuff. So it was fun to do that. Lauren does Sudoku, although she is also more of a crossword puzzle person, but she's a puzzle person. I never really thought of it. It was never really something that really came up, but I what has been revealed to me in her choice of iPad games, especially, but in general, leisure kind of like, especially during a lockdown activities, is I married a puzzle person. I did. Mm. She does crossword puzzles every day. She's got the jigsaw puzzles. We're in a break now. I think after, when we started lockdown, she started doing jigsaw puzzles on the coffee table in the living room. And there was a period there of like 3 months where there was always a puzzle. I think she's maybe jigsaw puzzled out a little bit, but like she's into puzzles and she gets Sudoku. But I think like you, the crossword puzzle is a more intriguing version.
I'm not as much of a jigsaw person. We did. It's funny. We had bought one when we were up at my wife's parents. They live up in New Hampshire. And there's actually a place called White Mountain Puzzles, which is in like the town they live. And it like did extremely well as soon as the pandemic happened. But I was like, we were in there like a few months before the pandemic. But like we bought a puzzle and it's still sitting on the shelf in shrink wrap. Yeah. We never open. We also just don't have a lot of space. Like, so finding a place to set up a puzzle that's going to sit around for a while is not really doable.
I admit, it was always annoying when I wanted to watch TV and put my feet up on the table and there was a puzzle there. I'm feeling like, puzzle. Right. But, sacrifices during this hard time.
Yeah, absolutely. Cross puzzle my thing. I also really just like, I mean, you know, I'm a big puzzler. I do the mystery hunt at MIT.
Yeah.
Every year, probably not this year. And I like they have like really inventive different styles of puzzles, and I have some friends who are very into that, and so it was very sweet. One of my friends, this is a weird story, but he's got like he ordered like soap refills, and he got the wrong kind. It wouldn't work with this soap dispenser. It was like the foaming soap instead of the like gel soap or vice versa. Anyways, so he's like, "Oh, I've got all these refills for this soap. You know, do any of you want it?" And I was like, oh, that's the soap that we use, and we can't find it anywhere right now because it seems to be out of stock at the places we usually buy it. He's like, oh, sure, I'll send it to you. So he sent us this, container of all these soap refills. But he also, being him, enclosed like a printed out puzzle that he had done in a hunt. And so last week when my wife and I were doing our local adventures for our socially distanced anniversary, we went to a local brewery, sat, at a table far away from other people, had a beer, and solved the puzzle together, which was delightful.
Nice.
And now I'm like, oh, I need more of those kinds of puzzles.
I thought you were going to say something like, one of these soap refills contains black ink, but it's near the one that contains blue ink.
You must, yeah. Why are all these soaps ink? This is the worst. It's the opposite of what I want.
Yeah, well, that's the puzzle, Dan.
That's a bad puzzle, Jason.
This is the part of the podcast where I normally talk about my Macworld column this week. Listeners to this podcast heard the moment where I came up with the idea for it last week. So just go back there if you'd like. But I did finally write out my influential Apple eras story, where it was basically an excuse to talk about how bad Apple was in the mid to late 90s, and how scrappy, as we were talking about last week, the earliest era of Steve Jobs was before they kind of got their mojo, where they were trying all sorts of stuff, including goofy stuff like Xserve and all their failures with .Mac and MobileMe and all of that, and the whole IBM G5 thing, which belly
flopped.
Remember
when they had a site that reviewed sites so they were kid-friendly?
I almost put that in there. I started writing that sentence, and I thought, I don't want to grind that axe again, but that was Apple saying, we'll do a better job doing editorial content than the professionals, and that did not last very long at all. Imagine like an app store, but for websites.
Yeah.
It was just a bad idea, and they had lots of them. It's funny. My premise really is, I've been doing this long enough now, and honestly, Dan, you've almost been doing this long enough now, that your knowledge is further back than the conventional knowledge is, and people are like, oh, well, of course, Apple's like this, and you're like, no, it wasn't like that. Like, people are like, oh, Steve Jobs could do no wrong. That, like, especially comes up since Steve Jobs has died, where people are like, they would have never bungled this badly if Steve Jobs were around. It's like, were you around in the 2000s? Because they bungled lots of stuff. We just don't talk about it.
Remember the time they made an iPod with no buttons?
Yeah. Remember that time that they did a software update and released all their software updates simultaneously, and everything crashed, so the new iPhones couldn't turn themselves on?
Oh, yeah.
Got home with the new iPhones? Yeah, they did that.
Or the time they released a software update that wiped external drives. That was definitely a thing back in the early to mid-2000s, I want to say.
Yeah, so anyway, I got to write that story. And what was fascinating about it, actually, beyond what we talked about last week especially, was trying to figure out what I would define the eras as. And so I decided to break it at John Sculley being hired. Basically, 92 is where I broke it, which is essentially like right before John Sculley got fired, because I felt like that was when they sort of crested the wave of the Mac being successful, and then it sort of became clear that the Mac was losing traction to the PC, and they didn't have another act, and then they spent this sort of weird 90s flailing around trying to do something else. And then
I remember, and then
Steve Jobs, the next purchase is clearly the next break there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the 90s, like when I would mainly hear about Apple, either reading my monthly Macworld when it showed up, or occasionally they would talk about them on the radio. And my father would always ask if he should buy Apple stock. And I think I started, probably it was like after Steve Jobs came back, I was like, yes, you should. And he didn't do it for many, many, many years. Like, literally, I think within the last 5 to 7 years, he finally bought it. I'm like, you bought it years ago, it really would have paid off for you. Not so much now. Still good, but not as much as it did, you know, if you bought it 20 years ago.
And then the other break that I decided to do was 2008. And I decided, because, you know, the iPhone became huge, but I feel like, and everybody was talking about it when the iPhone originally came out, but I felt like I was going to break it at the App Store. Mm-hmm. In 2008, because that seemed to be when everything started to accelerate dramatically, was when the App Store happened around the iPhone. And then that era is the rapid acceleration. It's the growth of the iPhone. It's the release of the iPad. It's, you know, it's the, you go from the iPod era to the App Store era, essentially. And then the other break that I decided is basically the era where we're doing this site, which is, it's either 2015 or 2017, but it's that moment where you look at iPhone sales and you realize they're never going to go up again. What's happened is they flattened off in 2015 and then came down, and then they've got another bump in 2017, and then they kind of have flattened since then. So take your pick somewhere in there, because I feel like that's the era Apple's in now, which is iPhone no longer growing expansively, but still throwing off, it's very successful throwing off huge profits. But the focus is on services growth and wearables growth. And that's the era we're in now, right? Which is iPhone stable, services and wearables growing. And who knows when this era ends and what the next era is and how, you know. But I feel like from the perspective of 2020, I decided that's probably the right break, which is the explosive growth of the iPhone was its own era, and now it's the what's next, services target, wearables target kind of era.
Right, yeah. No, it definitely feels different than it did. I mean, yeah, I think just going by sort of a non-easily describable, like, feel about Apple, like, it is easy to sort of pin down, like, yeah, the early to mid 2000s Apple definitely had a different feel than Apple today, and certainly the time in between that as well, when it was just growth after growth after growth. It just seemed like explosive felt different as well. And I think it's harder sometimes to realize, you know, obviously you can't realize those inflection points really until you're looking back.
Right.
Like, and say, oh, that was kind of when stuff changed. Right.
That was the fun challenge in this, is I've never really thought of it from these terms of, like, if we look at the entire history of Apple, how would I break the recent history up? And those were the decisions of, like, how do I break scrappy Apple when Steve Jobs just came back from what comes next, and how would I define that? And are we, my first draft of this, it was like scrappy Apple and then Apple, you know, super Apple. And there were just the two. And I said, that doesn't seem right. And so I added the third concept, where there was sort of scrappy Apple, explosive growth, inflationary, expansive growth Apple, and like today's Apple, where the iPhone is flattened out and they're looking for other things. But in the moment, it's very hard, which is why it was kind of fun to look back and try to break that up now that we've got at least a little bit of perspective from that period.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And you know, there will be more eras yet. We're not in the ultimate evolved form of Apple either.
No, I mean, that was how I ended the article, is basically, you know, if I've learned anything in following Apple all this time, is that there's always, you know, another change around the corner. And whether, you know, I don't think there's going to be another doom age for a while, but I do feel like either they're going to hit on another thing and go off in that direction, or they will enter this kind of like eternal stasis period that a lot of big companies do, where they become so successful that they end up kind of becoming flat and milking the money out of their profit centers and, you know, slide into irrelevance over time. And that's what Steve Jobs tried to get the corporate culture to never accept. And so if they follow sort of Apple being Apple, which they seem to have done that already, because the services and wearables stuff is Apple not stopping at the iPhone. So if they keep doing that, then they will just keep doing new eras instead of kind of entering the last phase, which is like a, you know, a star sloughing off all of its gas into space as a nebula and eventually just being, you know, completely diffuse and empty, which is kind of what happens to a lot of these companies, is they just fade away in relevance until they don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Like a star is what I'm saying.
Like a star on the main sequence.
Yeah, they would be off the main sequence, right? It's like, oh, are we still on there? No, we stopped fusing hydrogen a long time ago. Were you not reading the quarterly reports? Sorry. We don't get the star quarterly reports, but I assure
That's true.
Someone does. In Star HQ. The Galaxy HQ.
Galaxy? Is that a Samsung phone? Samsung Galaxy HQ? Could be.
It could be. The Space Patrol uses that phone.
Oh, that's right. So my past week's Macworld column was about Google.
Right.
And
remember Google?
Apple. Yeah, remember Google? They're still around. Taking shots at things that Google, services and stuff that Google has been, you know, obviously the de facto category leader in for some time. I think it's interesting, you know, Gruber did write an interesting post, I think it was this past week, where he talked about Android and Google and how Google seems bored by Android, which I thought was really interesting. Like, I don't follow that as closely. Like, I keep, you know, one eye on Android and you know, Google's announcements about it. But it does seem like they spend less time talking about it than they do about some of the other stuff that they're working on. And, you know, specifically, I think John was talking about the Pixel and the trouble they've had establishing that as a brand. And I feel like, though Android is obviously still super popular and it's a huge platform, most of the what makes it popular is not Google, but the hard, you know, the handset manufacturers like Samsung and the other big guys who are still building all the stuff for it. So I think that's an interesting observation. I don't remember hearing, did Google pushed off I/O this year and they didn't actually end up making any announcements, right? Like, I think they canceled even the virtual one they were going to do.
Yeah, I think so.
So like, I kind of was like, yeah, I guess I haven't heard anything about Android in a while.
No.
But I'm sure there's stuff going on. It's just, you know, it doesn't seem to have hit the zeitgeist at this point. But I do think it's interesting that Apple spent a lot of time building out features in iOS 14 and in the Mac and just services overall that are deliberate, you know, moves against things that Google has done. One of them being mapping. Last year, we had the look around feature that came to iOS, where it was essentially Street View. Mm-hmm. And that's moved to the Mac this year. Translation. is another big thing. Apple spent a lot of time talking about translation and really pushing the fact that all their translations done on device, so it's very private. You don't have to worry about it going to the cloud, which, if that's not a shot against Google, I don't know what it is. But it also deals with the struggles of the fact that when you get, I think we talked about this a bit last week, was like when you get to that level, like of the atmosphere, to continue our astronomical analogies, so the air is so rarefied, there are very few people who are up there. It's Apple, it's Google, it's Amazon, it's Microsoft, you know, and you always kind of, you know, they may be competitors, but they also kind of maintain a uneasy alliance as well, because you know that if you want to get stuff done, you know, contact tracing or security standards or stuff like that, you kind of have to have buy-in from all the major platforms. So you got to kind of have this this relationship, but at the same time, you're going to sort of build out stuff that competes, and that's interesting to watch.
I wonder, tangentially, I wonder how well, I'm writing something right now about Safari in Big Sur, and I wonder how well extensions developers, browser extension developers, are going to support Safari. Mm-hmm. Just sort of an idle wondering, because Apple is adding web extensions API support to Safari, and it's going to be in, because it's Safari, and this doesn't, it gets conflated with the operating system, but it's actually not true. Safari 14 is going to come out for Mojave and Catalina as well as Big Sur. So they'll have a long, like every Mac basically is going to be able to run the modern version of Safari when it goes final this fall. And so they'll all support web extensions. But to do a web extension, you know, I don't know. I'm like, there's a Chrome extension store, right? Essentially. Mm-hmm. So they're not unfamiliar with this concept, but what it does require is these developers of browser extensions to get, first off, I think they have to get Xcode, do they?
And then, so I actually tried to port one over because, oh yeah, I was curious. There's one that we've been using for D&D called Beyond 20.
Right.
And I was like, well, it's available. Like, the source for
it's
all
source.
Available.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to grab it and see if I can build it in Xcode. And the answer was yes, but I quickly got to a point where it was broken, and I was like, I could probably fix this if I spent a long time figuring out the JavaScript and how it works, mm-hmm. but I think this is a little bit beyond me right now. It wasn't the trance, like, it certainly got to a point where I could launch it, but yeah, the tricks are, you have to get Xcode. You have to build it in Xcode, and Xcode will essentially generate an extremely bare-bones app that basically just lets you, you open the app and there's literally one window with a button that says open the Safari preferences, like window in Safari where the extensions actually live.
Right.
Which is weird because it still has to go through the store.
Through the app store. Yeah.
And so I think Apple has worked hard to make it as easy as possible for developers to port their stuff over. The bigger issue is going to be, I think I ran into some scoping security issues in terms of stuff that Apple is not letting you do,
right,
that extensions may want to do. And some of that may be possible to adapt to. The real question is going to be whether or not the people making those extensions care.
That is the thing that I'm torn by right now, which is, I think it's great that Apple's doing this, but it's not the case where it's like, yay, you can just go to the site where they have a Chrome extension or a Firefox extension and install it in Safari, because you can't. That's the trick, right? Is they need...
Somebody has to do the work.
They need to have a Mac, which is immediately a hurdle, because a lot of these people don't. They need to then have Xcode, and they need to bring their development environment up, and they need to change things that might be security issues that Apple is requiring them to do a little bit more work on. And then they have to submit that app to the App Store.
Right.
Which, again, like, the benefits here are potentially great in that you're reaching a whole other browser, and so you're reaching Mac users, and I would say presumably iPad users in the future, maybe?
Seems plausible.
I mean, they haven't announced it for that, but I don't see why they wouldn't let these things, once they air this thing out, I don't see why you wouldn't get access to that. But again, access to the iPhone and the iPad would make this more...
Sure. I think the question is too, right? Like, if you need to make changes, is this stuff where you're like, well, I'll change the whole app and find a way to adapt it for Chrome? Or are you then maintaining separate versions, like forks of your project for different browsers, which might be more overhead than you want to do. I think it probably really depends on how much do you either care about addressing the Mac platform
right.
for either personal reasons or for business reasons, right? Like, are you making enough money off your extension that you feel like, hey, this would be a big improvement to, you know, like people who are using Safari.
Right.
But I think there's kind of a chicken and egg problem there too, which is, you know, most Safari people who users don't install extensions now. And they're certainly limited now, but I think most people probably don't unless they use an app like 1Password or something that includes an extension. They might use it, but it's a hard sell because you got to get your extension in front of people, make it easy for them to install it, and make it easy for them to understand what the benefit of it is.
I do wonder, there might be some opportunity, right? The Beyond 20 developer could put it in the Mac App Store and charge for it.
Sure.
And actually, because they're like Donateware, basically, they could put it in the Mac App Store and charge for it and say, if you want to run it in Safari, pay me $2 and you get to run it in Safari. But is it worth it for them to do that? And that's, I mean, my larger point here is not about any particular extension. It's more that when we report on new features like this, where Apple is adopting some sort of standard, but then it's adding its own gateway on top of it, its own, you know, hoops you have to jump through. I think it's got to make you stop and say, and I will say this in my piece that I'm writing, just because they built it, does that mean anybody's going to come?
Yeah.
And what's the motivation? And I really do think that now that we're talking about it, like, I feel like the motivation is probably ultimately access to the iPhone and the iPad.
Sure.
And that the Mac alone is going to be a tougher sell, but at least it's a starting point, and some will come over. Like, some will come over and Apple will promote them and all that. But I do wonder. That's like a really cool feature of Big Sur that I have my doubts about whether it will really be what it could be, because Apple is requiring, again, it's not bad to have additional security requirements, but also having it all be built around Xcode and the Mac App Store. You know, these are JavaScript plugin developers who, they're not Mac app developers, and now they're being forced into that workflow. So I'm skeptical. That seems like there are a bunch of barriers that have been thrown up there. But yeah. I hope it happens though, because, you know, I keep Chrome. I'm a Safari user, so I like Safari to get better, and I keep Chrome around essentially for all of the other things that require extensions, or like that one website that still does Flash.
Yeah, right.
Which is like, December, guys, gotta get on it.
or the backup for just like, oh man, the site isn't loading in Safari.
Yeah,
I should check Chrome and see if it works there. You gotta have a backup browser.
Now that I have two websites that behave, including most prominently all of Six Colors, that behave differently whether you're logged in or not.
Yep.
I also use Chrome as the other login state for my sites, so that I can have on development sites and on the live site, so I can see it in both views.
Yep. I remember well my days as a web developer having to have multiple browsers, and in fact using services where you could submit a URL and it would basically try that URL in, like, I think what were probably VMs of like several different OSs and browsers running on that OSs, so you could see how it behaved on all of those, including, like, at that point in the early 2000s, you were worried about like legacy browsers and stuff that was older. Like, oh man, how does this load if someone loads up Netscape, you know? And so you would get all these like screenshots back essentially of your site and be like, oh yeah, that looks totally broken on that one. Do we care? Maybe not. But yeah, those were the heady days of the browser wars, and lots of people with browsers that had very different opinions about how you should implement certain things. And I think that's calmed down a bit.
Right.
Not 100%.
Mostly. Yeah, it's like how John Siracusa is a web developer that we know, you know, famous for other things, but he's a web developer. And when he talks about Safari, he's always talking about how it's essentially another browser for him, because he's in Chrome, but he has Safari there too. So yep. He also has lots of tabs. I don't have lots of tabs. But tabs are much nicer in the new version of Safari. I will say that, with the little fav icons there. And then also when they get narrow enough, they just collapse to just be the fav icons. It's nice.
Yeah, you did have the fav icons were there in the earlier version, but I think you had to turn them on.
Yeah, right. Now they're on by default, and they've got
a
nice little collapse behavior. And it's a... Yep. It's a Yes, that was the great, you know, Gruber-led debate about whether we should show icons and tabs or not, and Apple's finally. But the big thing is that currently in Safari, if you turn on that feature, they all kind of cover and overlap. And in the new Safari, this is really the big UI change. Is in the new Safari, they hit a threshold where they know that you can't read the title of the page, and they just collapse to the fav icon at that point. Which is better. It's better. Well, this has been a whirlwind of a podcast.
We've been all over.
We've been all over the place. But that happens. And that's good. You going anywhere next week? We still okay next week?
Yeah, we're fine.
All right.
I'm not going anywhere.
Next week.
End of July.
Next week, I hope to announce... originally exclusively on this podcast, a new project.
That's exciting.
That I have been working on for a long time. And I think ready to announce it next Friday.
Hey, day after Apple earnings. Very exciting.
Yes, I will be having fun. I'll definitely be having fun with charts next Thursday because it's Apple earnings. We can talk about that, and I can announce my thing. That's next Friday. Okay. This was Friday.
That's something to look forward to.
Maybe we'll have a new label with interesting copy on it.
Okay. Yeah, slap that on the podcast.
Yeah.
Enjoy with friends.
Exactly. All right. Until next week, then. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.